Today is May 22nd, 2009. This is Conduit. The panel is Riding Evil Overlords.
Anything to say?
Before we get started, I think that I'll let all the panelists introduce themselves. I'll be the moderator. My name is Clint Johnson. I'm a writer of children and adult fiction. Right now I'm publishing in the children's market. This is my first nationally published book. It's titled Green Dragon Codex. It's published under the pseudonym Artie Henham. If you want to know why, ask Stacy. She'll be at this conference as well. And I love to interact with people at conferences and things like that. If you have questions, comments, go to my website, clintjohnsonwrites.com.
I'm Dan Willis. I also write young adult and adult fiction. I'm part of the reason why he's publishing under a pseudonym.
But I'm going to this story now.
Because the Wizards of the Coast wanted to get them the children's market very quickly, so they produced a single story with four books with four different authors, of which I was one. Those books, unfortunately, are out of print. My latest is Dragonlance, The Survivors, and the Crazy Eight Presents line. Cool. And that's me.
When did that come out?
That came out in November. They don't have any in the bookstore here today, but they will later. So. Okay.
And I'm Roger White, and I've been writing science fiction and fantasy since the 80s. Publish on my website, White World, and have been doing a whole lot of things as well as writing. So.
20 years ago, we used to work as tech writers together.
Yeah. I'm Ian Farland. I write science fiction and fantasy. I have about 50 novels in print now. Coming up to that pretty close. Within the next year or two, I'll hit that mark. And then I can start working towards my first 100.
Yeah.
I also go by Dave Wolverton sometimes. So lots of Dave.
It's like that flipping license plate in Cannonball Run.
James Bond had one first.
Roger Moore had the car that was doing it in Cannonball Run. Which
I think they had the car at the International Spy Museum in Washington. I'm Ann Sharp, and I am do not have a book in front of me. I'm probably the only person to see the whole writer's end of the con who does not. I'm Marion Zimmer Bradley's executor and trustee of her Literary Works Trust, and we're still putting stuff in print, even though she died almost 10 years ago. When she did die, I thought there were about a dozen different projects in various stages of the pipeline, which is everywhere from the publishers bringing it out in 2 weeks, right up to, well, we found these notes on her hard drive. Something. Actually, there turned out to be more like 20 projects, and you know, we're still publishing Sword and Sorceress, and so on and so forth. So I am not technically an author. I'm certainly not exactly a publisher and not much of an editor, but I'll really tell you how to improve your writing. In real life, I actually write standards to encourage the better production of, let's say, my department operates long-distance gas transmission pipelines. So, organization, operation, construction, and maintenance of same, because it's really what I do in real life.
Sounds cool.
My name's Howard Taylor, and I drew the picture on the front of your program book. I did not create Ming the Merciless, but I have created a number of evil overlords for Schlock Mercenary, the comic strip that I am well known for. If you want to know more about me, Google Howard Taylor. I am an e-famous, i-celebrity. Everything you want to know about me, including things that I don't want you to know about me, are available now on the internet.
Blog type.
It's there.
Well, okay. We are talking about writing evil overlords, and as we're all writers, I like to start with semantics. Let's start with the level of definition. What distinguishes an evil overlord from a more standard antagonist? Is it simply a matter of having underlings? Is it simply a matter of having resources? Or is it something more than that?
Let's start at one side of the panel and then head down, and we'll start here. Okay, you're looking at that. To me, an evil overlord would be somebody that has some kind of epic quest, epic level goal, and has a lot of people moving in that direction. The difference, of course, being if you ever see a movie where there's a heist, think Die Hard, where the heisters are the bad guys. None of those guys can really be an evil overlord. The crew's too small, the goals are too fine. An evil overlord is somebody with grand aspirations and either the power or the charisma to carry along a great number of people with him. Or her.
I like that.
Well, yeah, what Dan said.
When I think about an evil overlord, in addition to being charismatic, why? The other thing that you have to really spend some time on is what is this person trying to do? And the reason I put it that way is that rarely does a person, evil overlord or otherwise, wake up in the morning saying, great day to do evil. There you go. And that's an issue. You know, in the mind of the evil overlord, rarely are they evil. So you have to reflect this in your writing if you're going to avoid the comic book evil overlord. I guess is the best
way to
put it.
Later on, I want to make a case that the comic book overlord can be a lot of fun to write and very well done if it's done right. It's one that's fraught with Malayan minds.
So, I think you meant the unintentionally exaggerated.
I was just having fun at Roger's expense.
I don't know. You know, I think there are evil overlords. You know, probably more people than we recognize. And I didn't really believe in them too much until I started traveling around the world and finding out that in a lot of countries, that's who runs your country. You know, and they might call him, you know, the Supreme Emperor or, you know, El Presidente or whatever they want. But the fact is that they're backing up their regimes with machine guns and death threats. So for me, the big distinction between evil overlords and, you know, other lords is, you know, sort of how they treat your people. You know, if you're a good lord, you have friends and family and happy, well-fed peasants. If you're an evil overlord, on the other hand, you have hirelings, henchmen, slaves, you know, those types of things. So it's in the relationship that you have to your underlings. That's what I would like to add.
Gosh, I'm
all
ready to disagree with you. Not completely, but I was actually thinking about Hitler. I mean, this whole panel subject makes me think about Hitler a bit. Mm-hmm. And I should tell you this, we're now getting into the personal story stuff, but my father was a naval officer and was stationed in Germany during the occupation. I was actually there as a small child, kindergarten age. But my folks talked to a good many Germans, all of whom had perfectly good recollections, had been adults when the Nazis were in power. And one of the things they actually said was, as is very well known, Germany had a very bad time, especially during the Great Depression. The mark's value fell so sharply that they practically used to lug it around in wheelbarrows. They would pay workers four times a day so they could go out and buy anything at all, because if you waited to pay them at the end of the day, they'd get a lot less for the money. And so, but one of them said to my father, "Well, you know, Mr. Sharp, Hitler promised us bread, and he delivered on the promise." And so I said, "That was why we actually voted for him in the end." And so I'm thinking, not so much, of course, you ended up with a lot of people who were not doing well at all. So, with which I certainly, you know, have no disagreement. But your immediate stuff may not be. You have everybody starving. In fact, having a lot of starving peasants is practically guaranteed to start thinking about a revolution, because usually peasants may not have it too well in any under either kind of a regime, and the people who are doing well under your kind of regime, the top 1%, wealthiest, ones who are getting all the tax breaks, whatever you have, are doing fine and have no desire to change. And when you kind of annoy the middle class, that's it. Typical history. Okay.
Oh, gosh, what makes an evil overlord evil? I think the ends by which, or excuse me, the means by which he sets out to accomplish his ends are going to define him as being good or evil, because most of your evil overlords don't have evil ends. You know, they don't want to rule the world so I can destroy it. They want to feed their people, and, well, the only way I can do that is if I retain power long enough to, you know, get these farms up and running. And, well, if I'm going to retain power, I need to put this group of people down because they kind of threaten me. And once you've pulled the trigger and, you know, gone down that path, well, now you got to start covering up some of your crimes and so on and so forth. And that's a good, I think, definition of an evil overlord. You've got high, as Dan said, you know, high, epic sorts of aspirations. And then the means by which you achieve them are mixed. I think one of my favorite recent evil overlords was, none of you have heard of this guy unless you followed Bob Defendi's Death by Cliche podcast, Fraldolf. Yeah, who names their child Fraldolf? Okay, he was a troped, cliched evil overlord who one day woke up and said, wait a minute, am I supposed to kill the peasants? His underlings were getting ready to kill the peasants who couldn't pay their taxes. And am I supposed to kill the peasants because the rains were late and the crops aren't in yet? Is that why we're killing them? Because it seems to me that if I don't kill them, I'll get my taxes in 2 weeks and I'll still have peasants. That realization, when he gets to that moment in the book, correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, I got chills, because now the evil overlord was not being stupid. You know, that decision was the point at which, oh, he's evil and he's effective.
And he's calculating how to do what I would argue is the one thing that separates really good evil overlords from ones that are just run-of-the-mill. He was turning the people who hate him into people who love him. An evil overlord who is loved and has loyalty, I think, is much more evil and much more powerful than the one that rules with the iron fist.
We all know that we're supposed to hate Adolf Hitler.
Right.
But in 1938, you know, if you named some of the most loved people in the world, his name topped the list, including among Americans. I mean, we saw him as kind of goofy, but...
it was the whole Charlie Chaplin thing.
Yeah.
He could have been, you know... He could have a good career. You know?
Yeah.
Great train robbery, too.
Yeah.
He's a better painter than I am. So.
I think that's right. You actually can make even the readers like an evil overlord. Like, I got to like Fraldolf by the end of the story. It was kind of a tragic character there.
I would like to add one thing on this that helps sort of combine this. And that's the people under the evil overlord. Again, we brought up Hitler as a pretty classic example of an evil overlord, and we brought up a nice point, which was Germany was in a shambles. And the way I like to put this is a community that gets badly stressed is very likely to follow an evil overlord. And it's really the stress. It's being scared. It's being really uncertain about the future, having the present where you're saying, my gosh, where am I going to feed my family? And adding to that, conventional solutions haven't worked. You listen to the Democrats and nothing happened. You listen to the Republicans, nothing happened. You listen to the Liberals, nothing happened. Who's left?
Cthulhu! I settle for the lesser of two evils.
There you go. So as you're assembling your evil overlord, one of the things to do is figure out what your community, what the followers are following. And this will put a lot of flesh onto an evil overlord.
The only comment that I'll add is
the idea of leadership seems to be a real key to this, and a genuine feeling evil overlord, which we'll talk about in a minute, needs to be able to lead in the wrong direction and persuade everybody that it's the right thing to do.
The evil
overlord needs to be so charismatic, so persuasive, that his evil outshines the good. To the right thing, just the wrong way.
Well, you know, when Hitler took over, the very night that he took over, he went in and sent in assassins to get rid of about 200 senators. And and I've often looked at the deadlock between the Republicans and the Democrats and thought, you know, I don't have to talk such a tactic.
I don't have to get a libertarian into office.
Well, we talked about stupid evil overlord. Okay? And the guiding question of this panel is, how do you write an evil overlord without making them campy? So let's talk a little bit about, why is it so easy to write an evil overlord who is campy? What is the challenge of overcoming this artificiality? And let's start this time at Howard.
Start at my end. Okay. Wow. It's easy to write a campy evil overlord. Is that the question that I'm supposed to answer?
Well, why is it so easy?
Why is it so easy to fall into the trap of the trope? Because it's been done. So it's, you like the wordsmithing
there?
Why has this been done so many times in the same way? Because when it was done originally, it was kind of effective. You know, we like Ming the Merciless. We liked Cruella de Vil. My phone was ringing.
Yes, it is. It's your phone.
It is my phone. That was good enough.
It's a little overlord
call. Yeah, it's actually the manager down at the comic book shop writing my pencil and inking, so it kind of qualifies. Anyway, the tropes are there because they worked once, and we look at them working, and we think, well, gosh, that's cool. You know, it worked in that story. I'll put it in mine. And you run this risk in any genre, in any aspect of it. Anytime you're borrowing from, you know, what already exists in the body of literature, you run the risk of, you know, being cliche, of sounding like, you know, you're just writing the tropes. The evil overlords list, and I don't know what the exact URL is online.
Google it.
Evil overlords list. It's like 150 or 200 things that I'll do if I'm the evil overlord that I will never do, or that I'll do instead. I don't think you need to look to that list and say, well, this is how I prevent falling into the tropes. Because the list itself is now a trope. The trap is there because we like writing bad guys with big aspirations, and there are a lot of them out there. I waxed long-winded, sorry.
No. Actually, that's the story idea I have. I'm still working on exactly the concept of taking that list and everything in there, just making it campy because he's not doing anything.
And see, the problem with that is that it's already been done. What you have described has already been done a half a dozen times, because the list has been around for 10 years. Yeah.
Do you have a problem with it? No, you have a problem with it. I don't know, Theresa Milton has a variant on it that's, you know, pull up a few items from it and write a story based on them. Because she says you can write a perfectly good story based on the evil on a selection of things from the evil overlords list. They're all right there. You just have to look at it and pay some attention. And so on. Or you reverse them. You say, well, I will never do this and such, and so on. So either you say, okay, I will do this and such, and it works out for some reason, and of course I have to work out very, very well, or I do this and it turns out very badly. You can, in fact, you can take almost any of these things and use them. Of course, we all have fun exaggerating our villain, partly because I think a really good villain needs to be somebody that the reader can identify with in good many ways, except for whatever that extra evil thing is. You want it, your ideal villain needs to kind of maybe have mother-in-law problems, a dog that cannot be trained. You know, I mean, just something that the kind of thing your ordinary reader will be able to identify with a bit, too.
I think that, you know, when you start looking avoiding the cliches of writing about evil overlords, of course, the biggest one is, you know, they're stupid, okay? I say, first, avoid stupidity. Second, they are evil. You know, I worked as a guard at Utah State Prison, and I knew some really, really creepy people, mass murderers, at least 40 or 50 of them. I never knew anybody that really saw himself as being anything other than moral, you know? I mean, I knew guys who would say, yes, it's true, if you steal dope from me, I will kill you, okay? But I'm not going to lie about it like the rest of these guys, you know? And I would never rape a child like some of these creeps in here, you know? They all have what I call piece of pie morality. So, you know, there's just one little thing that I'm going to do. And just because I've got a little piece of the pie of morality out here gone, you know, doesn't mean that overall I'm not a great person. So that's my second thing. The other thing is, I never have my evil overlords do the brouhaha, you know? It's true that evil people do that. You know, I remember the first time, you know, you get kid got knocked down as a kid, you know, and some kid laughed at you, you know, and like, look at that wimp on the ground, bleeding all over, crying like, you know, he wants his mommy, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, they do laugh at you, you know, but my evil overlords never laugh unless they hear a good joke, you know. That's sort of the rule. So,
one comment going along with that. Driving pleasure in the pain of others most of the time goes along with a position of weakness. Right? If you have an evil overlord who is genuinely powerful, he doesn't necessarily feel anything about quashing opposition. It's just something that has to be done. He might even feel some remorse for it. It's something that has to be done. Yeah, they're not going to lord over squashing a bug.
A lot of it has to do with familiarity. When you're writing, why, if you write a character that's totally out of context, the reader's going to have a tendency to say, what's all that about? And so there is familiarity. And this, what a problem with an evil overlord is when they become essentially too familiar. And you say, oh yeah, he did this, I can always going to do that. He's going to start saying, whoa! That's when you get into a problem. But you do have to, there has to be some familiarity, otherwise the reader won't relate. And it's a balance. It's an issue that you really have to balance. But if you get too much familiarity, then you end up with campy evil over.
I think part of the problem we have creating evil overlords and then having them have no teeth, essentially, we've all been ruined by short-form fiction. Television is what's killed us. We're watching stories that are designed to be told in an hour, and so in order to get the story going, they introduce the bad guy and immediately have him drown a puppy. And they do this.
Puppy kicking.
Yeah. Or they'll kill a child or some other really heinous thing. So that you now, the viewer, understand that this guy is just you. And we fall into that need, I think, as because no matter how much we read, television comes at us so much faster. And there's so much more of it that I think that it works its way into our storytelling styles. And in fact, my first novel, my editor looked at it and said, you realize what you have here is a zoom-in. It was very visual, I mean, because I'm not a visual person, and I experience much more visual media than print media.
Just tell your editor it was done in books long before it was ever done
on film. But it was just an interesting revelation to me that the visual media affected me that much, because I read a lot. It's not like I don't read. But anyway, we have the desire, I think, to hurry along the villain. And I think the villains whose villainy develops are probably more interesting to readers than villains who just come out and explode in evil all over the first page. The example I would use would be Star Wars. You know, Tarkin didn't blow up a planet at the beginning of Star Wars. It was in the middle. And, you know, he is arguably the face of the Empire in that story. He's the face of the evil overlord, even though the Emperor isn't there in the story. And so you guys whose evil develops, I think, it would make them much, you talk about making them more real. Making them feel like real people. And you know, having somebody shoot a puppy in the first scene might make them seem evil, but evil overlords are that way because they're not necessarily unlikable. You know, if they're shooting the puppy, it's because it's rabid. You know, there's something, there's a reason for it. And I think that leads to the other thing is that we fall into is having guys who are evil for evil's sake. And you can camp with, you can get campy with that. You can go really, really over the top with that and maybe be successful, but I think your odds aren't very good.
One thing that I always look at when, if I were to write an evil overlord and I'm planning some, I don't think that I've actually written what I would call an evil overlord in any of my stories, is I know that I will have written this character well if at certain times you as the reader really feel like you should be on his side. He's making a better case than my protagonist. And I especially would love to be able to achieve where you're having fun because of what he's doing. Some of the great villains, and you might call evil overlords, right? You could think of things like the Joker in The Dark Knight, or take Silence of the Lambs, or even go back to Shakespeare. The plays of the characters of Iago and Richard III are explorations in evil where he's trying to package it so that it's fun for the reader. All Richard III is Richard saying, okay, I'm a bad guy, I don't like what's going on, so I'm going to tell you how I'm going to ruin this person's life. Then he goes out and does it. And then he comes back and he goes, wasn't that cool? And you feel, that was kind of cool. You know, the hunchback manages to win the young princess after killing her husband and taking away her support. You go, I can't help but admire that guy. I wish I could do that. And when you get your reader saying, I kind of want to be this guy. And then they realize, whoa, what does that say about me? To me, that's what I want my evil overlord to do. Now let's talk a little bit about the relationship between your hero, your protagonist, and the evil overlord. Because we always talk about how the protagonist and the antagonist are shadows of each other oftentimes. So what type of hero or hero's journey is appropriate for a genuine evil overlord? We can either go from one side to the other, or we can just chime in.
I'll chime in. I think that just as your hero has to grow from being, you know, very often idealistic young man to genuine hero, somebody whose courage, has courage and intelligence and direction in life, and you know, basically has all of the qualities that we want to emulate. I think your villain also has to go through a journey where the villain's journey is one of perhaps self-discovery, but that he keeps discovering that he's a worse person than he ever imagined. You know, that there's nothing to which he will not stoop in order to, you know, attain his power, regain his power, make sure that he gets what he wants, get rid of his enemies, etc., etc., hide his crimes. And so the villain keeps basically discovering that, you know, as he goes along, that one by one he loses his noble ideals and becomes, you know, the thing that everyone around him hates.
I think that you've got a really important relationship between the hero and the villain, especially if you're a fan of the Campbellian monomyth. If you get into that, you'll discover that there comes a moment where the hero must reject the bad guy.
Yes.
And so you get these wonderful opportunities, especially if you've set up your evil overlord, to have a goal that makes sense. He's not a Bond villain. He's not going to blow up the moon.
Yeah.
He's got a purpose. And his purpose is noble. He's trying to right some great wrong or purge some great injustice. He's got some kind of a mission that normally you might be able to get behind. And there comes that scene in every story like that where the hero faces the villain and the villain says, come to the dark side, we got cookies. You know, I mean, that's a perfect example. Empire Strikes Back, here's Luke on the hand cut off on the out of the thing. And what does Darth Vader say? Join me. And we will end this destructive conflict. What does he want to do? He wants to end the conflict. He's tempting Luke with everything Luke wants. A father that Luke has missed. You know, the ability to be important, which Luke has desired. All the stuff. He's tempted. Unfortunately, that scene gets lost in the eye on your father. bit that kind of overshadows that moment. But that's a moment every hero has to have.
It's so, training to become the Jedi.
Yeah. That moment where the hero looks, or the bad guy looks at the hero and says, you know what, I could use you on my team. And presents the argument in such a way that we, the reader, believe that the hero is honestly tempted. The other side of that coin is Live Free or Die Hard. Great movie. I enjoyed things blowing up and mindless flight. It was great. But there's a scene where they do exactly that, where the Bruce Willis is in the big tractor trailer. And if you haven't seen the movie, I'm not going to spoil too much for you. And he's chasing after the guy. The jig is up. The guy is now in, and he's no longer in I'm controlling my universe mode. He's in flight mode. And get the heck out, escape. And he tries to convince Bruce Willis that his motives are noble. He says, well, you know, I did this because I warned these people, and they wouldn't listen to me, and they ruined my career, and they, you know, they ruined my reputation, and so I'm proving to them that I was right. And of course, by this point in the story, we, the viewer, know that that's crap, because we've seen this guy be really evil. Bruce Willis's character knows that that's crap, so it just doesn't work in that scene, because we've already come too far down the road. But it's the, they put the scene in, they just didn't do it well.
Yeah, earlier.
Yeah, earlier might have been better.
Yeah, I've been thinking about holidays, and I think the villain is the one who wakes up on Christmas morning all happy and says, oh, I wish I could be like this all year long. And the good guy is the one who wakes up the morning after Halloween and says, oh, I really wish I hadn't done that. And that dichotomy makes for some really deep characters. Your villain thinks he's the hero of his own story. We're talking about the relationship between the hero and the villain. You want to write a good villain, write a villain who thinks he is the hero, whose goals are noble and whose compromises must be made. There are sacrifices that have to be made, and it hurts, but I'm doing the right thing, and he's the hero of his own story. And the hero may feel like he is the villain of his own story because he doesn't want to leave the farm. He doesn't want to abandon his family and go on this quest, but somebody's got to, and this is just awful. And you start blurring that line, and whatever tropes there may be regarding evil overlords and heroes and monomyth and all that, you may be able to avoid it.
I've heard the word tropes before elsewhere, and you've used it now twice. Could you actually...
I think I've used it four times.
It was 3.7. You said tropes once.
But you just sound like...
Apparently everyone's counting
down. Isn't that a group of circus performers?
Never mind.
Good, yeah, thank you. Trope is similar to cliché, but cliché... Cliche is a phrase, okay? Trope is a mimetic cliche. I'm making up
situation.
A situation. It's a situation
cliche.
That's the joke. It's a situational cliche. Sneaking in through the air ducts is a trope.
Especially since they can't actually hold people.
Well, that's, yeah.
Hey, on spaceships, they can.
Where do you think Miles were cozy again?
So, the one problem I have with what you're saying is that the evil overlord saying to the hero, join me.
Well, that doesn't always happen. That's only if you and the kin fight.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of it. And as you point out, most of the time, you have to do it well. Otherwise, it's sort of like it's in the movie, like a car chase is in the movie. Yeah, we got it there.
Well,
we'll get to it. Yeah.
And there are different levels that you can do it at, too. Yeah. One of them is to say, join me, you know, we can together we'll rule the universe. The other one is to simply give the guy a nod and say, you know, you're more clever than I anticipated. Or, you know, it's the acknowledgement that says that, you know, you as the hero are surprisingly good or valuable or whatever. And that's kind of the ultimate compliment is to offer, you know, share the wealth.
But
why
would
I
wanted
him
to be like you?
Yeah.
Yes, I mean,
exactly.
It could be that kind of.
Yeah. But I'll bring up a mystery for you. The evil overlord mystery. This is one that I've thought about a long time. Who here is familiar with World War II?
Remember, I should have thought of it.
What was the final battle in the European theater. What was the final battle in European theater in World
Berlin?
Berlin. Very good. Okay.
Falling of the Berlin Wall in 1989.
Okay. Battle of Berlin. What can you tell me about it?
Well, from what I've read, it's the Americans and the Allies kind of stayed out of the city and let the Russians do all the dirty work, and that the Hitler was hunkered in his bunker, and then he committed suicide with his lover or whatever, and a lot of the Russians kind of felt gypped by the Allies because they thought, well, we've been taking most of the casualties, we've been fighting the brunt of the forces, why aren't you fighting this battle with us? That's what I know.
Good. Anybody got an idea how many people died?
The city was
100,000.
Well, close. About a million.
A million.
Big battle.
That's a
big battle. Went on for 10 days. Now, here's the mystery. This is the end of the war. There's nothing left of Germany. You've got the big Allied army that's marching up to the Elbe River. You've got the big Russian army that's marching up to the Elbe River. Why did this battle get fought? The Russians could have stood outside and said, you haven't surrendered yet? The Germans. Who's going to rescue us? There isn't anywhere else. There aren't anybody left. The only one that's going to save us is aliens. But they fought. And they fought and killed roughly a million people. Why? Why? Now, there's an evil overlord story for you. Okay? You essentially had evil overlord Hitler, and you had evil overlord Stalin. And the people were willing to back them. The Germans were willing to back them. They didn't say, oh, I'll surrender. This is hopeless. The Russians were willing to fight. They were willing to lose another 500,000 people to get this over with quickly. They said, yeah, we want this done in 10 days. There are some evil overlords. Those are people who had followers. This is the kind of thing that you want to put in your story. Of somebody who could get that kind of following. What did that take?
Stalin was so especially good at it that when he died, people, political prisoners he had put in jail wept. I don't understand that kind of charisma, but that's
he's still very popular.
It's a Russian thing.
It's a Russian thing.
But think about that. Especially these are some real-life evil overlords, and they developed fanatic followers. You really can't call it anything else. Fanatic followers.
The evil overlord always represents a powerful, compelling vision. And one of the reasons why the protagonist so often gets the offer to join them is because your protagonist, as really your point of view character, is your main tool in showing the battle that that vision creates inside people. Right? This is going on in the wider society, and we see the results of that. We see the cost of that and the benefits. Right? Because there need to be benefits as well. But when it comes to actually facing the choices that that vision presents, that usually happens in your protagonist, in your hero. Because they feel the same temptations that everybody else in this society does, genuinely speaking. If you have an outsider hero who isn't tempted by the evil overlord's philosophy, I think that would be more difficult to pull off and make relevant.
Going along with what you just said there, I think that the offer to join me scene is not always necessarily an offer to join me. It's the hero saying, hey, wait a minute, I'm doing pretty good here. I might actually be able to bring this guy down, but do I really want to? Just like you said, the evil overlord is trying to accomplish some goal, and the hero probably at one point says, hey,
what if he's right?
I've got a point here.
What if he's right?
Try my hardest to bring this guy down?
If he's one of those evil overlords who feeds the peasants, who's going to feed the peasants now?
Maybe I should just let him do his thing and stop doing this. Not necessarily the overlord offering to join, but the hero saying, well, maybe I should just let this go.
Right, and that's a great way to make your hero a real bastard. Some heroes stay heroes. That's necessary.
Yeah, some heroes stay heroes. Some become heirs to the Overlord, and some become followers.
Yeah, and then with the giant battles and things, things snowball. I mean, no matter how evil your evil Overlord is, the populace, at least that's the evil you know. And when you have, when you've had an army that's gone through and rampaged through half your country, killed your cousin, your best friend, and his dog, and said give up or we'll kill you, or we'll kill more people. Once the tide turns, people don't necessarily always have the clearest thought pattern of, hey, let's end this, maybe I could die, what's the real point of killing all these other people? All you remember is they killed Uncle Bernie's pet.
Yeah. And also, you got to know that in these large battle sorts of situations, the soldiers on the front line do not have the evil Overlord's Twitter feed keeping them updated on everything that's going on. And you know what? We've decided to surrender, so just everybody throw down your gun. That doesn't happen. You got, you and the people you can see who you know are your friends are holding weapons, and those people on the other side of the river are also holding weapons, and the last time you checked, it was your job to kill them. So that proceeds until the confusion lets up.
Yeah, that's why Andrew Jackson became our president.
Right.
Because the Battle of New Orleans founded his career, basically, and it happened after the war was already decided. We'll wait for further comments until we cover one more question, and then there will be some specific time for questions from the audience. So, the last thing that I think that I'd like to cover is, let's look at some very specific applications of this. From your own writing, would anybody want to talk about evil overlords that they've created, how you did it, why you did it, and what it brought to your story? And I'll just toss this up to the panel.
Okay. Well, I've done a couple of evil overlords, but in the Rulords series, I have an evil overlord who's trying to gather all power and become the sum of all men, because he sees that a great battle is going to come between mankind and these creatures called Reavers. And I thought it was interesting, because in my mind, he was the evil overlord. But I got a lot of letters from people saying, man, I really love these books, but one thing that I'm wondering about is Rajatan the villain or the hero? And I thought, I wasn't trying to be that obtuse, yes, but they saw him as an effective leader, and every once in a while he does something that's completely nice and likable, like save the little girl, that he could have just passed her by, that's what evil overlords do. But no, he had to stop and take a minute to save the child, and she's eternally grateful for that. So that's what I was doing. What I was really trying to do was, I was trying to depict two societies that are battling over finite resources that are going to soon be depleted in sort of a senseless war, as they're trying to decide, see who's going to get the supremacy. And that's kind of what I was after. I was trying to strike this little balance thing. But that's one example of the evil overlord.
I did a convention in 2004 where somebody asked me, Howard, which character in your comic strip do you most identify with? And I thought about it for a moment. I said, I would rather not tell you. and then I told him anyway, because, how do you not deliver the punchline? And the character was General Zinchov, and who was at that time one of the more significant baddies in the strip. And the gasp that went up from the audience was delectable. It was tasty. It was the sort of moment that us writers we live for. Yeah, we savor those moments, because I realized at that moment I did it right. They really hate him, and I just told them I like him. And I think he worked, because I spent about 4 years as the marketing manager or a $100 million business unit, and was regularly exchanging small portions of my soul for a steady revenue stream. I was familiar with the ethics of compromise and with dishonesty. That's one of the reasons I quit that job, is because I've since managed to purchase back about 75% of the soul that I lost. I got a little ways to go. But that character I identified with him because he knows more than you do. He knows about the challenges that the human race faces as a member of Galactic Society. He knows the big secrets. And he knows that if you know the big secrets and the big secrets get out, billions of people are going to die. And so your life versus billions of lives, well, that's easy. Bam, you're dead. Okay, let's move on. Clean up on aisle three and let's move on. And that was one of the reasons that people despised him so much, and it was one of the reasons that I identified with him.
Okay, I'm not, I do not, as I've said, actually write Evil Overlords, but anybody taking notes, take notes. I will highly recommend a particular book to you. It is by C. Northcote Parkinson. Anybody familiar with Parkinson's Law? Work expands to fill the time available? Everybody knows it. So, Overlord? No. He actually wrote a book called The Evolution of Political Thought. And while this sounds frightfully, frightfully technical and perhaps Dylan Moring, it is not a Dylan Moring book, and it definitely describes something that people who write about evil overlords might find somewhat useful, which is what happens when one of them dies. Because evil overlords tend to end up as dictators and something. And so, but Parkinson assesses what happens. You go from this kind of society to that kind of society, from a feudal society to a monarchy to a middle class to a despot, something. And he says it goes in cycles, and here's what happens. And here's what happens when you have an evil overlord. You have someone like Hitler. And what happens to Hitler? He destroys virtually anybody close to him who might conceivably be his heir. You know, when he did die, he was stuck with an admiral who was not terribly political. The admiral was actually out there running the Navy and saying, I'm a professional naval officer, let me do my job. So when Hitler died, that was all that was left. And the naval officer stood up and said, okay, I'll take the responsibility. I'm a Navy brat, so I understand this very well. So I took the responsibility, went to prison for it, but was not executed. It was recognized all around he had just done his job.
His job was.
Well, yes. Well.
Would anybody like to make a final comment from their own writing, or should we turn it over to questions?
I'll add that I find it difficult to write evil overlords. I don't write evil. And part of that is that they're too big. And usually if you're going to have a problem, you can have a problem on a small scale and still care about it. And so, yeah, as I'm thinking back, I'm trying to think if I ever wrote an evil overlord. Truth is, I haven't ever written one. I've written some evil people, but I haven't written an evil overlord because it's too big.
I think that's a really important point. An evil overlord isn't always the best choice of antagonist. Don't automatically assume that increasing scope increases relevance. Sometimes having a very personal, one person conflict, or person to self conflict, is going to be more relevant and more potent than marshaling all of the armies of hell. And so this isn't a tactic for every story.
Let's see, it'd be interesting. I was just about to comment. I'm working on a story right now that has an evil overlord in it. And he's kind of a cult leader. And he's attempting to fulfill this prophecy of this group of people and do it without precipitating full-scale war. In order to do that, he's going to kill several hundred thousand people. Well, full-scale war would kill a whole lot more than that. So, in his view, that's a win. But he, interestingly, is not the bad guy. He's kind of like the Emperor in Star Wars. He's there, and he's a force, but he's not seen so much. The villain is one of the characters whom the protagonists keep running up against. So, you can have them without necessarily, have to have everybody seen with the guy petting a white cat. Okay. Do we have any questions? No, I saw your hand earlier, so we'll stop here, then we'll go here.
It seems to me there's some kind of a balance at scale. The more believable and interesting and likable your evil character is, the less likable and interesting your hero is. How do you maintain that relationship where you still want the hero to win at the end of the day? If the overlord or the evil villain is smart, sometimes your hero has to be not so smart or inept. But I mean, I've seen it done that way. How do you make it successful so that the characters are still satisfying at the end of the book?
Don't predicate the success of one on the weakness of the other.
Yeah, the villain is... Well, let me back up a moment. What you're describing, and what we've talked about a little bit, especially when I was talking about blurring the lines, the Christmas Halloween thing, there's a little bit of moral ambiguity in there. You introduce it in the villain, you introduce it in the hero, and as the two get closer together, you realize, I hate both of these people, I'm putting the book down. As an author who likes getting paid, that's not the book I want to write. So you take that moral ambiguity, and then you step back, and you say, okay, the villain has heroic aspects, and I want people to like him, but the hero is just a really all-around good guy. And, a very little bit of the ambiguousness enters in with him, and I think you can solve the problem. That makes sense?
Yeah. Both characters are undergoing internal crisis with competing visions and options. The hero wins that. The evil overlord loses. The overlord succumbs and the hero doesn't. It's not a matter of one's weakness facilitating the other's strength. It's two strengths competing until two very respectable, admirable, capable entities, one eventually comes to the point where their philosophy fails.
You guys have read a software program called Dramatica, which is very expensive and very cool. They have this philosophy that all story is an argument that you, the author, are making, and you put up opposing theories for scrutiny, and your story tells what you think the outcome of that is. And so that's really, when I talk about the decision moment, the join me moment, it often doesn't happen in the presence of the bad guy. A lot of times it's the good guy in his own mind going, is this really what I want to do? Am I really on the right side of this? And if your hero has that moment of introspection and you do it right, there shouldn't be any doubt in your reader's mind who the villain is and why. And right, and you're absolutely right. Sometimes we get into the point where we write these wonderful villains, and the heroes are kind of like, I don't want to read this story about the hero. Why don't we read more of the villain? You know? Why don't we read more about that guy? But it's dangerous.
You know, ultimately, when you look at it, if you have two people of equal strength, and they're both determined, they're both intelligent, they're both, hardworking, 20-hour-a-day kinds of guys, and you're looking at them as possible leaders, okay? The difference between the villain and the hero is quite simply one of selfishness. The hero ultimately commands vast armies for his own ends. The villain. Villain's looking for his own ends. The hero's commanding vast armies for the common good, okay? That's the only difference. And what comes right down to it comes to a matter of support. Who's going to win the hearts of the people? Eventually, your hero typically has some side effects. And when I talked about the importance of the relationships between him and family and friends and sidekicks and whatnot, that really is important, that there are people who are supporters there, helping him in that quest to show that he's not just some lone gunman, out there trying to take down empire. This is really someone that does have leadership potential. So.
Let's take one more quick question, and then I will give a little time to each of the panelists to tell you about signings that they have or do a little pub.
All right. Final confrontation between hero and villain. How do you write the dialogue without being cliche? Seems like everything that comes out of my pen is cliche when it comes to the final confrontation.
What do they still have to talk about? You know what? By the time it gets to the final confrontation, if you've got a big reveal, if the big reveal was going to take place during the dialogue, somebody's going to get shot before that got revealed. Congratulations, you have material for another book.
No, we've seen that scene so many times that you know, anything that you say pretty much is going to be cliche. But as you create your own world and your own universe and your own situations and circumstances, you have to tailor the dialogue to fit within the realm of your story. And that's really all that makes it, that's going to distinguish it from the same scene that we've seen in many other books before. One thing I want to say is this. You know, there's a saying that, the old tales are the best. Well, quite frankly, what people are really saying is the ones that have stood the test of time. You know, when we start looking for tales, those are the ones that we remember and think about. And don't worry so much about not being cliche, you know. I mean, if you're trying to be fresh and original all the time and you're not pulling on the monomyth, then you're probably doing yourself a disservice.
Okay, let's start with Power and then just go down.
Do you have anything you want to...
Book release party for the Scrapyard of Insufferable Arrogance. Tomorrow, 4 p.m. to 6 p.m., I'm buying the pizza.
Okay, I'm doing a reading tomorrow at 2 in the executive boardroom. I'm doing a reading at noon. I'm then doing a signing at 2. Also, I do a little online writing workshop. I actually do a daily kick in the pants. If anybody would like to get on that, I've got paper and pencil up here. You can give your email address and sign up for that.
I've got my writing posted on my website at whiteworld.com. Roger White, my world. And I'll be doing a reading tomorrow at 2.
I've got a reading tomorrow at 4:30 and a signing tomorrow at noon. This doesn't come out until June 9th. I will be having my first signing at the King's English on the 6th. And it will be my first ever signing, so I'm going to go. All right, thank you all.